This is a FUBAR Radio podcast. If you need any more information, head to FUBARradio.com.
Nick Helm and Nathaniel Metcalf's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
I said, I haven't got my headphones on, and I think I said that into the microphone because I turned the microphones up and then grabbed them.
You willed them.
My mic was hot.
Hot as in?
Live.
Right, not hot as in just, it's a bit hot.
Sexy. Sexy Mike. That's what they used to call me when...
Your name was Mike.
When people thought my name was Mike and I was too polite to correct them. We'd known each other for months by that point, so it was too late to change it. My name is Nick Helm, and I'm joined in my studio in the studio today by Nathaniel Metcalf.
Hello.
It's never easy. It never gets any easier.
No, you'd think it would. It sounds easy, probably, if you're listening.
Yeah. So what
you've no idea how hard this is.
You've no idea. That's another thing that I used to say to people when people thought my name was Mike. Oh, God. This
hot mic.
Disgust. Hot mic. Welcome to Nick and
Nat's Fan Club.
Just to reiterate, it's not our fan club. We have no fans. we're sort of fans of stuff, but we're here to encourage people to come in and talk about what
and we're fans of each other. Maybe that's saying too much.
We're fans of hanging out.
Hanging out,
chatting, relaxing on call, shooting some. I regret getting into that as well. The first rule of fan club is
tell your friends about fan club.
You're up in Edinburgh at the moment, aren't you, Nat? So how's that going?
Well, I guess it's probably just starting.
Second rule is tell your friends.
Tell your friends.
How's Edinburgh going?
Oh, it's going wonderfully.
I bet you're running around all over the place trying to get flyers out and.
Yeah, flyers are out. I'm doing little bits in people's shows probably, and running around.
You're looking after yourself.
I'm trying to eat some fruit.
Yeah, eating plenty of fruit.
Try to have a banana to keep my energy up.
Sure. But I mean, have you been to Pie Maker this year?
I have, yeah, and I've had one of their like hot dogs that's inside some mash or something.
Sure, yeah, and they do a macaroni cheese pie as well.
They do.
Or mac and cheese, as we now call it, but it's macaroni cheese.
Yeah, I think Sanders has slipped where we stopped saying macaroni cheese.
Macaroni cheese.
Mac and cheese.
I remember, when we were growing up, when I was growing up, I mean, we didn't grow up together, but we were all growing up in a way. Mm. But I remember...
We're still growing.
I used to really love macaroni cheese. I was a real... fan of it. Really loved it. And I remember once when I was little, you know, kids, if they don't get what they want, they cry. And I was crying a lot because I really wanted to eat macaroni cheese. And my dad, to appease me, boiled a pan of macaroni. Mm-hmm. And he cooked it, and then he grated some cheese on it and gave it to me. And if anything, that was just pouring paraffin on the fire. He knew that's not what I wanted. And now that I'm older and I've learned the secrets of a roux sauce, it's not hard, Dad. Yeah. You could have gone that extra mile for me.
Child abuse in some ways.
Child abuse. That literally was mac and cheese. You be careful what you wish for, Hoxton. So I love a bit of mac and cheese. What are you? So
what have you been a fan this week? Mac and cheese.
No, but there's nothing saying that you can't come in and talk about food. But we were talking about your Edinburgh show. How many reviews have you had?
I've had two.
Are they all on the poster, are they?
Yeah. One says, smashing. What a smashing show.
Yeah.
And the other one says, I liked it.
Good.
And they've all got lots of stars on them and things.
Yeah. Only really one star on the poster, isn't it? No. You.
Thank you, Nick.
Oh dear.
We have fun, don't we?
Oh, I love it. it. I love it. It's 1 hour a week where I literally don't think about anything other than enjoying myself. And then directly afterwards, I do worry that I've ended my career. I try and repeat it over in my head and just think, what did I say? What did I say? But yeah, that's fine. What have you had any time to watch anything? I'll tell you what's happening in August. This is a pre-record.
It is. I'm in Edinburgh. But we're currently in London in the past.
This is a few months before, but not a few months. It's
a few weeks.
You've only got like...
I've only got a few weeks till Edinburgh.
You're still writing your show, but you'll know whether all of that work that you're doing right now will have paid off by the time this airs.
I fear I will.
If you can get your head around that, Nat, it's terrifying.
It is.
But no, I think that you're probably doing very well. We just don't know, do we?
We don't know if I'm still alive.
Oh, God, I hope you are. But Goblin are playing, aren't they?
They are. They're in Edinburgh. And here, though, right? They're doing...
Well, I'm not going up to Edinburgh. This is... Oh, God, I really, really wish I was going up to Edinburgh. I've got a cracking idea for a show as well. I wish I'd done it. Save it for next year. But Goblin are the band that they did the soundtrack to Deep Red and Suspiria. Mm-hmm. And did they do Phenomenon?
I don't know. Maybe that was...
They worked with Dario Argento a lot, and then they also did an alternative soundtrack to Dawn of the Dead.
That's what they're doing, Dawn of the Dead and Suspiria.
I think it's Suspiria and Dawn of the Dead, actually. In London, they're doing Suspiria on the Friday and Dawn of the Dead on the Saturday.
Yeah, I think that's the same in Edinburgh. The same days, but...
Yeah, but not Dawn of the Dead and Suspiria. Suspiria and Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, that way around.
That way around.
Okay. Yeah. That's Goblin.
So I love Goblin.
Me too.
Their soundtracks are absolutely fantastic.
I reckon I saw Deep Red for the first time when I was about 17, and I became obsessed with Goblin, but just off the back of that. And that was at a time when you just couldn't get anything either.
Yeah.
So you're just like, who are Goblin? And I thought they just had such a sort of mad name as well, like almost like a parody of what a sort of prog band would be called.
Right, yeah,
and you
yeah.
almost think, are they even a real band? So like I sort of remember seeing the thing come up, like Music by Goblin, and like finding it quite funny.
Mm.
But then by the end of the film, I was like, I loved that soundtrack.
Yeah.
And it felt like for a while you just couldn't get... So like Goblin as a band, when I saw them a couple of years ago, I was like so excited to see them, because it really did feel like you discover them.
Well, me and you went to see Deep Red together, didn't
at the Barbican.
Yeah, you said,
oh yeah,
did you get the ticket? No, but did you get the tickets? Why did we go?
So yeah, probably. I think so.
Had we already seen Goblin by that point? I know that they played the Electric
Ballroom.
That's
right. We'd seen them at the Electric Ballroom. And I'd seen them, I think, the year previously at the Scala. And the Scala show was amazing. And the Electric Ballroom show was okay. And I was a little bit disappointed because I was so, like...
Yeah.
I think I might have been like, you got to go. It's amazing. It's amazing.
Yeah. Oh, because quite a group of us went, didn't we?
Yeah.
Chris Boyd.
Yes, it was.
Richard Sandling.
Yes, it was. Yeah, there was a whole bunch of us.
Yeah.
And I was a little bit disappointed by the Electric Ballroom show.
It's a bit like when I got everyone finally to come and see Alice Cooper with me, and he did his Wake the Dead bit. He did his cover version of...
Waking the Dead.
Of
the BBC one.
Revolution by John Lennon, wearing his John Lennon glasses, and it was just like, oh, no. He did Foxy Lady by Jimi Hendrix, and it was just one of the worst things I've ever seen. And everyone looked at me as if to say, why did you bring us all the way to Wembley for this?
It was. That was a Goblin show where at the end they have like screens up so they can show clips from movies and things. And
but they weren't in sync, were they? It was like
clips of. And then at the end, they did a thing where they showed some footage of themselves at like a massive concert.
Yeah.
And it was
huge.
But that's not here. So it's almost like they're going, usually we play really big venues in Italy.
Yeah, but it was also from a while ago.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It was kind of like misjudged.
Yeah. And the band is Claudio Simonetti.
Judge the room, Claudio.
And it's usually like whoever young musicians are with him.
Yeah, yeah.
So it feels like they're interchangeable. And a lot of the band that were on stage weren't the band that were in the videos. So it made it even more...
Yeah.
That seems a bit inappropriate or...
I thought it was good. I enjoyed it on a level that...
I think it
was a night out.
Yeah.
But when we went to see Deep Red, mm-hmm. that was life-changing in a way. Because now I'm upset. Like, so I was... What did I watch? this week. I watched Demons this week, and I started watching Demons 2, which is Bava, not Mario Bava.
Oh, Lamberto.
Lamberto Bava. Is that his son?
Son, yeah.
So Lamberto Bava, and it's written by Dario Argento. And I've had them for ages on the side. I just never got around to... But I'm going through Mario Bava at the moment, and I've got Lucio Fulci, and I've pretty much watched all of Dario Argento's films. Mm-hmm. I love them. But it was, I think, really... I'd seen Suspiria, and I'd seen Inferno, and I'd loved both of those. I think Suspiria is a great film.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my favourite films, I think. Inferno, I think, is... not as good a film, but I think beats it slightly in terms of dream imagery. Mm. I think Inferno, there are sequences, it's got amazing sequences, but there's plot, there's a bit plodding. But there are sequences in Inferno when you feel like you're actually watching a dream. You know, it's bit when she goes underwater at the beginning.
Yeah.
It's such a weird sequence, and it just has like dream logic to it. And it's the closest I've ever seen something feeling like you're in a nightmare. I loved it. I love it so much. And then you took me to see Deep Red, and God, that I think that has got to be one of my all-time favorite. I think it's the best cinematic experience I've ever had.
I had it when I saw it when I was about 17 at the BFI South Bank, and it was like I came out of it going, well, that's one of my favorite films. Like instantly, you go, that's one of the best things I've ever seen.
Yeah,
and it also felt at the time that didn't seem to be the Argento film people loved either.
No,
so I was like, that's my favorite. That's the best one I've seen.
But when you look at his whole thing, he did some sort of like low budget giallos. In the late 60s, early 70s, but like Deep Red was quite early on. It was like 72, 73, and then Suspiria gets all the glory, but then by the time he's made Phenomenon, he's not really making great films, and his 90s stuff is terrible. Dracula, his remake of Dracula, I think we might have talked about this even.
I've spoken to you about it. I don't think we've done it on Fan Club.
We have. We are going to repeat ourselves at some point. But the Dracula remake is amazing. But the Suspiria is gets all the glory. But Deep Red is the fact that I keep mentioning it, I suppose, is testament to how amazing it is. It's such a good film. But when we watched it with Goblin playing...
the live soundtrack.
The live soundtrack underneath it. And I hadn't seen it before, and I was worried that Goblin would... ruin it.
Yeah.
Not ruin it, but like I was just thinking, so what? I don't know the film. Is there going to be any dialogue?
That's what I wondered. Are you just going to drop out all the dialogue? So you're not just going to watch the film?
We're just going to watch the film with no sound to it, and then they're just going to play music over it, which is what I thought it would be. And it wasn't. And the music in Deep Red is pounding. It's just sort of like, it's so sort of urgent and alive, and when you see him with the actual band, it's great. I'm really looking forward to seeing Suspiria
with the live
with Goblin, and I'm really looking forward to seeing the alternate. I suppose Dawn of the Dead has got quite a famous soundtrack, hasn't it?
Yeah, I'm less. I think I'd like to see it with them doing it, but I don't have the. I mean, I like Dawn of the Dead, but I don't think it's one of my favourite films or anything. I enjoy it.
I prefer Day of the Dead. I think Bob, the zombie, Day of the Dead, makes that film.
Yeah.
It's also got kind of like the most creative deaths. It's got the stuff that, you know, when Dylan Moran gets pulled apart at the end of...
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Shaun of the Dead.
That's all stuff from Day of the Dead. I really like the ending and the setting in the military base, and it's obviously Dawn of the Dead is a classic. But in terms of entertainment value, I like the remake.
I like the remake a lot, actually. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I think that the satirical elements of the original are really sort of heavy-handed, and I think the fact that they're going on in the background of the remake is kind of like, that's great. And it's not like overtly political. And by doing that, I think that it works exactly in the way it's intended. And also you have the bit when they're shooting celebrity lookalikes.
Exactly. That's the bit I think about when I think about
it. It's just really...
It's a really funny idea.
It's a really funny idea, but it's a fun film. It's got a great ending. It's got an amazing soundtrack. That opening sequence...
I was going to say, yeah, when it has a camera pans up and everything.
Camera pans up and she's driving and you see like the apocalypse. It's just... It's just... There's so many good bits to it. And I think that it's one of the... I went to see a... I was at a horror film festival and the Dead by Dawn in Edinburgh. And they made a big speech about how remakes are awful and how you should never remake. And it's just kind of like, I don't have a problem with remakes if they're done well. The remake of Dawn of the Dead is always the remake of Dawn of the Dead. It's not Dawn of the Dead.
Yeah.
You know. I think that they still exist next to each other. I think the Suspiria remake is interesting.
Yeah, and I think it looks good and interesting. And
it looks different.
Yeah, but I think it's got the feel of it, isn't it? It feels like it's got the similar kind of tone to it that I quite like.
Sure, right, yeah. It's just, I mean, it's such a creepy idea, and the original is kind of like a really creepy film. I mean, if you've not seen it, you should definitely see it. But, I mean, oh, God, it's great. I just think that, like, visually, Dario Argento made some really just brilliant... visually striking movies. When you go back and you watch Mario Bava, though, I mean, that Blood and Black Lace film, I mean, that's gorgeous. And Kill Baby Kill, I think we talked about this last week, but or the other week, but yeah. And then, it's time for a song. Okay, this is Rocketing By. Thank you very much. I don't know who I'm thanking.
and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back, joined in studio now by we're joined in studio now by or with
by
joined by
that does sound weird now saying it out loud
joined by joined I mean, with Marit Larwood. Marit Larwood,
hello, it's nice to be joined by you.
join the club. Welcome to Fan Club.
It's lovely to be here.
There was something that I was going to say about the thing that we were talking about before.
Dario Argento.
Yeah, I've put my notes over there. I'm just going to go and get it. But,
what were you talking about, Dario Argento?
We were talking about Dario. Because you can't hear in the other room, can you? We were talking about Dario Argento remakes and stuff. We've just been filming together, haven't we, Marek?
Yeah, we've made a program.
And I say just. It was months ago now, wasn't it?
Well, I like to say just because it means that I've worked recently, I haven't worked for 2 months. Can we just say just?
I started the year very well. I did a film, a short film, and a series, and then I've been doing a lot of writing since then, which is basically waiting for work.
Yeah, and now it's July. You know, can you swear on this?
Yeah.
You've just fucked, aren't you, until September?
Well, this is August now.
It's August now?
Because this is a pre-record.
Oh, it's August, and now you're just fucked until October.
There's a great bit in there's a South Bank show with which is all about Richard Attenborough, and there's a bit where, and it's when Richard Attenborough's making Chaplin, and he's having a chat with Roger Moore, and there's just a nice bit with these two quite old people having a chat to each other, and Richard Attenborough goes, "Oh well, now Rog, of course, I'm at the age where, I mean, I just can't direct all day. I always have to have a nap in the afternoon, otherwise I'm fucked for the rest of the day." And Roger Moore just went, "Well, lucky you." And I went, perfect Roger Moore response. And it couldn't have been scripted better. That's exactly what you'd want Roger Moore to say to you.
Did you hear that Roger Moore story that someone told? I can't remember, it was on Facebook. I can't remember, Mark Haynes, I think it was. And he, when Roger Moore died, there's other people telling their stories. Did you read this one that he saw Roger Moore at the airport, and he wanted to go and speak to him, and he went up to him, and he obviously said, "Are you James Bond?" And Roger Moore said, "Yeah, he's James Bond, but he pretends to be Roger Moore, so like the spies don't get him." And then 20 years later, Mark Haynes bumped into him again, just on some filming job, and he explained the story about when he went to him in the airport and said to him, "Oh, you James Bond," and how he said this thing. And he said it in front of the crew, and everyone laughed. And then later on, Roger Moore went up to him and said, "Yeah, about the story, of course I'm James Bond. Of course I remember you from 20 years ago. I'm still keeping up pretense that I'm James Bond." It's great. A really lovely story.
That's right. Really
I
nice.
Didn't tell it very well, so there we go. Just look it up on Facebook.
Well, it wasn't great radio, but I think that it's nice to leave people with a bit of homework after
you
the
want
show.
To do the research yourself. Just, I mean, basically, you can just Google. You can Google everything. If you just do Google everything I say, someone's written it better on the internet.
You've made a film called 2 Hours, haven't you?
I made a film. I filmed 3 years ago. I can barely remember any of it.
It's a pre-record, so maybe you recorded it. Maybe you filmed it years
18 years ago. I made this film.
Also, people can listen to this whenever they want. So,
of course,
25 years ago, I made this seminal film.
I like the fact that the film's called 2 Hours, but it's 83 minutes long.
83 minutes.
Yeah, that's what's good about it, isn't it?
Subliminally, you think it's longer.
It's got Keith, naughty old Uncle Keith Allen in it.
He filmed all this stuff after we filmed it, about a year later, I think. Keith Allen.
Really? So he's separate, isn't he? Like, he's not in there.
They hadn't cast it, the person yet, so they just basically had an actor reading in the lines who was desperate to play the Keith Allen part, but not famous enough. So,
did Keith you know it was going to be Keith Allen at the time?
No, it was going to be a whole host of people. I mean, it's a film aimed at people who are 9 years old.
It's a children's film. It reminded me of like the Children's Film Foundation films, like the kind of the
Tommy that, Super Tiger T-shirt,
with Keith Chegwin.
Yeah, it reminded me of like one of those.
They were great. Yeah, this was it's quite a weird job, which Sean Walsh got me involved in. It was really good fun, and I think it's a fun film. I don't think it's maybe something that adults would watch. Something you watch with your kids are annoying you over some holidays, you can put that on, but
sure.
bear in mind it doesn't last for 2 hours.
There is some stuff for
you've got if you put it on, you've got to come back and collect them within an hour and a half.
There's going to be a lot of children. I mean, if you're a kidnapper,
yeah,
and this ever gets shown, you can get there 1 hour 23 minutes in.
Yeah, and their parents and won't be there for another.
Kids wandering around. Yeah,
it's a perfect opportunity.
In many ways, it was made with kidnappers in mind to give them 37 minutes to commit. It's their crime.
It's worth watching it just for the moment when you see a kid on top of a building and you say, he's tossing himself off.
The line was, he's about to jump off. And I was trying to make Sean laugh. So I said, oh, he looks like he's going to toss himself off. And they kept it in. And they kept a number of things, which when we were running down the stairs, and I said to Sean, I'm just going to do the Starsky and Hutch sort of. That stayed in. I don't think the sound guy was paying attention to anything.
And the people making it, were they on board? Were they also going, this is a funny thing for the mums and dads?
It was, as a job, it was one of the most enjoyable jobs I've ever done because it was no real pressure. I think with a low-budget film where they're allowing you to do what you want, there wasn't really any sense that you could mess anything up. I don't know if that's translated on screen. I mean, they say that the things you really enjoy turn out really badly. But, you know, to see what your 9-year-old son or daughter thinks of it, I think it's good fun.
Yeah. Well, I enjoyed it.
Thanks, Nick.
That's all right. But that's what we were talking about. We were talking about remakes just before. When we were filming together, we were talking about John Carpenter's The Thing, weren't we?
One of the greatest films. Which is a perfect film, I think. It's a perfect film, it is.
Yeah. Good. Right, we've got that.
I don't want to discuss it anymore.
Because we were talking the other week about what a perfect film is. I don't think you can sit down and make a list of all the perfect films, but when they occur to you, I was like saying that Groundhog Day, I think, is like a perfect film, and Back to the Future is sort of a perfect film. And then I think that, you know, they're films that you can watch over and over again, and there might be plot holes in them as well. It doesn't need to be like watertight.
Yeah, I don't know, because it's funny what the definition of a perfect film is. I think they're like a perfect film for me is almost something where if you assume that all films are 5 stars and things just you knock bits off of it, if something you go, I don't like that, don't like that.
What a nice way of thinking about it.
Whereas, like,
films as shit. And as soon as I sit down, they've got to really make it.
They've got to impress.
They've got to be better than the trailers.
But if they start at 5 and you're just going, if something bad happens, they're getting worse and worse and worse.
That's a real optimist to think things start at 5. I think my perfect film definition is when you watch it, it's normally they're all sort of old films like Jaws and things you've watched when you're younger.
Yeah.
And when you go back and watch it, you think, oh, that was just nostalgia making that great. But when you watch things like The Thing,
yeah.
And I think that stands up, and you're really pleased. It's not shit, and it's not your brain.
Do you think Jaws is nostalgia?
I was just about to say. I think Jaws does stand.
I think Jaws is brilliant as well.
Oh, okay.
So it's just a bad example.
Yeah, it's a bad example. I think Ghostbusters I watched recently, and I found Bill Murray really sleazy in it.
He is,
but to the point where you know, Me Too campaigners wouldn't like it.
Sure.
But he was uncomfortably sleazy about Sigourney Weaver, and I didn't remember that at all. I just thought he was a sort of a kooky sort of snidey depressed character, but he was actually a real sleaze.
Yeah, I think that has aged very badly, maybe within the last 5 minutes. Do you know what I mean?
Well,
it's like it's a film that
Ghostbusters. I watched it about a year or two ago, and I was a bit disappointed. And that was one I hadn't seen it for ages. But I thought I was going to love it. I really sat down to watch it. Like, yeah, Ghostbusters. And then there's like loads of bits in it where you go, I mean, why is that, man? The sort of ghost blowjob thing with Dan Aykroyd's weird, and you go, I mean, this is like a PG. Mm. It's quite plainly that's what's happening. It's just in the middle of a montage.
Dan Aykroyd wrote a sequence where he gets a blowjob from a ghost.
Yeah.
And then they've gone, well, we filmed it. And it's actually involves quite a lot of special effects. So we'll have to use it in a montage. That's how we'll use the footage. Yeah.
It's funny, isn't it, that that's made in an era where they're making like a PG film.
Well, that's the thing.
But they're going.
Yeah, but I don't think they were thinking. Or
no, they
make
weren't.
A kids
they don't
film.
They don't think like
I think back then, What it feels like to me was they just made films.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they'd get categorised.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it's...
Like, Jaws was just like... They didn't go, we're going to make a kids' film.
Whereas every film that comes out now is probably filtered through that thing, innit? They know what they're going for. They know it's going to be PG.
Well, if it's a PG... like, an 80s PG is at least a 12A.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Well, that's why that 2 hours film was only 1 hour and 23 minutes, because there was a 37 blowjob sequence with a ghost. Well, several different ghosts. And they thought, that's got to go.
That's the version we watched. I think we got an earlier cut.
That's really good. At the start, just 37 minutes straight.
I only watched the 37 minutes. I thought, that's a bit weird. Because it was Temple of Doom, wasn't it? Temple of Doom came out, and then they were just like, oh, it's so dark that we're going to have to invent a new category.
Over here, they had Batman, weren't they, as well, that made that was a 12.
That was the first 12 in England.
Yeah.
And over there, I don't know if... Indiana Jones, Temple of Doom.
I think it is that, yeah.
I think it was Gremlins that was PG-13.
Maybe.
But Temple of Doom just got in, and then they said, do you know what? We're going to have to invent a new category.
Yeah.
Which was PG-13 over there. 15 over here.
An age for every single film.
Yeah. I think they do in Europe.
All the way from like 1 to 18. Yeah. What's the maximum? Is there a 25 or something?
Yeah, they should have films that you can't see till you're
much
older.
Better. It'd be something to look forward to, though. Like, 25th birthday.
Oh, yeah, 18. You're still young. I mean, you wouldn't think that when you're 18, but when you're older, you just think, I was a baby when I was 18 and I've seen some awful stuff. Imagine watching, Serbian film.
Yeah.
I mean, that's life-changing and not in a good way.
Do you remember when there was clubs when it was over 25s only? And I just imagine, like, just pensioners and really old people just playing chess and just talking about politics non-stop. Over 25 clubs. Now I can go to all of them.
I don't remember over 25 clubs.
Yeah, it was on the Isle of Wight.
So they wouldn't want kids in, so they'd just say, it's over 25s.
I don't remember that.
I bet they're awful.
Maybe I was never stopped.
Just mums and dads on a night out, really depressed.
What's your favourite film?
I think it's quite hard. I like The Thing, and I like...
Would you say The Thing was your favourite film?
That, and American Werewolf in London. I think I might have a cartoon in there, The Watership Down, I put in there for...
Love it.
For nostalgia reasons.
American Werewolf in London and The Thing, they are... do you know what? I'm having such deja vu in this episode. I thought that I'd heard that Roger Moore story before. I mean,
you've probably
told me that before, but you haven't told me that on air.
No.
This is why we should never talk to each other
ever.
Unless we're on air.
Yeah.
Because I'm having deja vu, because I think that I've said this forefront thing before. But I had American Werewolf in London and The Thing on... They were like forefront... Video VHS. They used to be $5.99.
Oh right, yes, yeah, I know what you mean.
You used to get them from Woolworths. Oh my god, how fucking old are we? Just fucking relics.
People listen to this thinking now should be an over 25s podcast. This is it. Over 35s.
Fucking a relic.
And we didn't have DVDs in them days.
I remember when you could watch a DVD with your front door open.
Well, do you know what? I watched fucking... I may have even said this. I went to watch Robocop and they were like going, can you speak into the mic, Merrick?
Speak into the mic.
They were like going, they went to see Robocop ironically and they were laughing at all the special effects.
Oh, yeah.
And they were like saying, oh, yeah. And he was explaining to his mates, this is proper 80s CGI.
Yeah.
And then you're like going,
it isn't CGI.
It's not CGI. It's not CGI. It's like, oh, man, check out the CGI on that 1933 King Kong. Oh, it's proper shit CGI. Oh, check out the shit CGI in Wizard of Oz. Check out the shit CGI in Gone with the Wind. Check out that shit CGI in Modern Times, starring Chappers. It's like, one of the things about your film that I liked was like halfway through he goes, the kid goes, I want to be like Steve McQueen on a motorbike. And I suddenly went on like a thing, just like going, I wonder if any kids now actually know who Steve McQueen is.
I mean, I don't think anyone my age would even want to be Steve McQueen. I think the scriptwriter was probably about 50.
It was just that, but like wanting to be Steve McQueen, I thought you could make a really kind of like quite like an ironic film where all of like the teenagers are sort of like very respectful for the past.
Yeah.
Well, I don't see why. I think it
maybe he's talking about the director of 12 Years a Slave.
He saw him on a motorbike once.
I saw him and went, I want to be. Oh, I'd love to be Steve McQueen, the director of 12 Years a Slave, on a motorbike.
I think that nostalgia is overrated. But I also think that when things are good...
If it is, we should go home. This is all we do.
No, it's not all nostalgia. I think it's like saying that some things are still good, isn't it? I mean, it's like...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You're saying... We're talking about Dario Argento, and it's kind of like, he made some actually excellent films that still hold up. I think it's about looking at stuff that still holds up.
Yes, yeah.
You know, I don't think it's nostalgic to think that Luke Skywalker should be treated better in a sequel to a film that he made. Do you know what I mean? It's not nostalgic to just say, treat those characters in a certain way. I'm not going to talk about it though, I promise. But fucking hell, what was I thinking? But I don't think it's nostalgic to say that there's something of value in the original King Kong, right?
Oh yeah.
Or there's something of value to watching Steve McQueen in The Great Escape. There's something that's The Great Escape, let's not forget, was made 30 years before I was born. Right, so it's kind of like it's a thing that you know, if I as a child can watch films that were made before I was alive and enjoy them, then I think that that's a thing that we have sort of like lost in a way, isn't it? That everything has to be immediate.
Yeah, I don't know that kids don't.
I think my friend of mine said he's got two young kids and he played them a load of Chaplin films and they absolutely loved it and they thought it was hysterical and were addicted to watching it. Because they just weren't told that this is not a new thing. Didn't have a noise, you know, it was just something for them. They didn't have anything to judge it against because they weren't sort of brainwashed by modern TV.
When I was growing up and I watched the Carry On films, I thought that they were new. So it was all the more heartbreaking to find out...
Everyone in them was dead.
They were all dead. Yeah, the Carry On films were like that, I suppose, for me. But also, like, watching Laurel and... It's so weird, like, what huge icons that time period of cinema were. When you grew up and you knew who Groucho Marx was. You knew... Like, I just remember going around my parents' friends' houses and they'd have pictures of Charlie Chaplin on the wall and Groucho Marx and Laurel and Hardy and... I'm not like saying that kids don't understand it, but when you're living in an age where basically they've just remade Die Hard and everyone's fine with that, even though they're still making Die Hard sequels, it's just kind of like a thing where it is all spontaneous, you know? It is kind of like...
Well, I guess that's the thing. If everything's available, do people watch stuff by choice? Whereas I guess when I was a kid, you'd have Laurel and Hardy on Christmas mornings and things, or... In the holidays, you'd have Laurel and Hardy on at 7 o'clock in the morning. You'd watch or something.
It's like new, but you need new content for the sake of new content.
Yeah.
Well, just for the sake of all the companies to exist and people and media to make money out of it. I mean, what I miss is the fact that with four channels and there seem to be long release periods, that there were things you could all chat about at the same time at school. I don't know if kids have that.
Yeah.
I mean, now it's sport, isn't it? Like the World Cup's quite interesting because everyone's watching sport at the same time, so Twitter goes mad. This one thing is happening then, whereas now film releases aren't really the same as big
I think
as they were.
It happens to a point with stuff like Netflix, though, right? With like Stranger Things or something, then everyone seems to be talking about it at the same time, even though they could watch it whenever. It does feel that there is that rush. I guess that's that thing with spoilers as well, isn't it? That everyone wants to talk about whatever TV show, they all have to watch it immediately in case it's spoilt for them by someone talking about it on Twitter or something.
What you want to do is send your children to a cult where they only have... Like Brigsby Bear. Have you seen Brigsby Bear?
Oh, that's fucking amazing.
All children should be brought up like that. Just in a weird sort of tiny little sort of commune type box. With selected programmes that parents have chosen for them.
What do you mean? All children?
All children should be brought up imprisoned.
I thought they were.
Yeah.
What?
Oh, no. Uh-oh.
Brigsby Bear, that is a film. That is a film that I had very low expectations. I think what it transpires that David Trent recommended it to me and I bought it on Amazon, but it had been in my flat for about 8 months and I'd forgotten why I'd bought it. And it was there, and every time it came to me sitting down and watching a film, it was never that. I was never in the mood to watch Brigsby Bear. And then I watched it, And fucking hell, it was just, it's incredible. I think I just loved it. It was exactly, it felt like it was a film that was made for me at that time.
Is it because
in my day,
it had the sort of innocence and hope that so many 80s films have? I was trying to work out why I like 80s films and why.
But it wasn't 80s.
I know, but it had the innocent hope of the 80s films, because it felt like he was a. That's something that I felt really. Like you talk about the Friday film specials. I love the fact they were just quite two dimensional films and quite simple, with really sort of simple plots, but you could enjoy them.
Yeah.
Whereas now, everyone is just trying to be cool and look good. I don't know if that's just me being old. I'm probably sound like an old. I am an old man. I am a grumpy old man. But I do think that sort of innocence and hope doesn't seem to be a big part of films. It's all about being cool now, isn't it?
Well, yeah. The thing about Bixby Bear is that you think that it's going to be sort of like an ironic kind of. It's sort of in style a little bit like Napoleon Dynamite, but you think it's going to be sort of like ironic and it's sort of taking the piss out of its subject matter. But they actually deal with it really earnestly, and it's quite a sincere film. And I think that's what I really liked about it. It was quirky, but it wasn't sort of like a bunch of hipsters that had made a film to take the piss out of it. It was kind of like they'd made something that was actually really genuine. And it made me... It was about nostalgia. I think nostalgia is really loving something despite all the evidence telling you that it's shit. Mm. Loving something from your past despite all the evidence telling you it's shit. And I think that... Like what you say, when you watch a film later on and it stands up, that's not nostalgic. That's a genuinely good film. It is weird, though. I do sort of like have to tell myself, you know, who's your favourite? Who's the actor that you love the most that would get you going to the cinema? I try and see films all the time. But when I was growing up, going to the video shop, it was always Steve Martin, Arnold Schwarzenegger. Later on, I got into Sylvester Stallone. But do you know what I mean? It's kind of like I don't feel like I have that one... film star that I would follow to the ends of the earth anymore.
I don't think you have film stars in the same way now, and I think people, when they become famous, they try and attach themselves to a franchise, don't they? And that's what gets them booked and rebooked.
Well, Dwayne Johnson is the is the franchise saver,
yes,
isn't he?
Yeah.
They put him in a but then he can't start his own franchises.
Yes, yeah.
Because every time he makes a film, it's Baywatch or something like that, where it's just like, oh, fuck. And he produced that as well. Mm. And you go, well, you were all over this film, and it's fucking awful. But when you put him in a Fast and the Furious, what else did he do? He did
G.I. Joe.
But, I mean, that didn't turn into a franchise, but, yeah, he did G.I. Joe.
I suppose Jumanji is...
Jumanji, yeah. You just whack him in a film, and all of a sudden it's... I don't know.
Well, Ryan Gosling is a film star. I think he's an old school film star. For me, he's someone I always watch in things, and I've got a man crush on. And I think he's brilliant. He can do comedy, he can do straight acting, he picks interesting roles. I mean, Blade Runner was a poison chalice to do that, and he managed to put it off without it being. It's not brilliant, but it's not embarrassing.
I thought Blade Runner was amazing, and I thought he was incredible in it. I love Ryan. I think Ryan Gosling is often very good. He's also, you know, La La Land he's great in, and what's the other
Nice Guys.
Crazy Stupid Love he's good in.
Oh yeah, Nice Guys was a great
He's funny in Nice Guys. There's a really funny bit. He was in the toilet, and when what's his name?
Russell Crowe
comes in, and he's sort of doing this sort of slapstick bit with the toilet door whilst he's sitting on the toilet.
Yes.
And I thought, that's so hard
to
do. Something like Michael Crawford would do.
Yes.
You know, and I thought, you've pulled off a really difficult slapstick thing and it's generally made me laugh out loud, and you're a straight actor.
But I went to see Nice Guys because of Shane Black, and I went to see Blade Runner because it's Blade Runner. I didn't go to see Ryan Gosling. You know, I'd say we've done this before, but I'd say Denzel Washington is kind of like the guy at the moment. If he makes a film, I won't necessarily go to the cinema to see it, but I'm definitely going to watch whatever that is, because I think he makes good films. Mm.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think other people like that are kind of nostalgic, aren't they? You'll have like when Kurt Russell's in the Tarantino movie Hateful Eight or something, you go, oh, I love that Kurt Russell's in a movie. But that's nostalgic. It's because you like Kurt Russell when you're a kid.
I still like Kurt Russell.
Me too.
Bone Tomahawk is a genuine... I mean...
Oh, yeah, it really
the
was,
the fact
yeah.
that he's still making cool films. But no, he's but always mean, like, been a B-movie actor, really.
Yeah, but he's... I mean, he's not a current era actor, and you'd go and see those films because you have nostalgia for Kurt Russell.
Paul Rudd is a great kind of screen person, actor.
Why?
I think he's really likeable, and I think he's funny, And I think, I mean, but I just, I don't want to see Ant-Man.
Paul Rudd sort of jumped the shark for me because I think he realises he's likeable. I think about 5 years ago, Paul Rudd realised he was likeable, and something, I when I watch him, I think, you know, you're doing the Paul Rudd thing now.
Sure,
and
right.
It's pissing me off. Right. You've over-rudded yourself.
Right.
What's the term for it? There should be a new term.
Yeah. I think I know what you mean, though. I think some people are like that. It's almost like they become self-aware of what the thing is people like about them.
I think probably that turning point for Paul Rudd was when he did season 9 of Friends and he was the best thing in it. And then in season 10, he got all but written out. He was like in a fraction. He was in like 3 episodes and he just popped up to say hello. And he didn't even have any jokes. In the 9th season, he was so good. And when they wrote him out, he must have gone, do you know what? I'm better than all 6 of them. And then that was the turning point.
And it's he has gone on. And my other favourite film star, who I think I always watch in things, is Hugh Grant.
Oh, I love him.
Oh, I love him.
Yeah, I absolutely love him.
And I think Paddington, in Paddington 2, he should have got nominated for an Oscar. I think it's one of the greatest performances of recent years.
I think
years.
That thing, that light comedy thing he does, is really hard. And it looks like effortless. And but I think that's he's got that thing again. I guess like someone like Roger Moore has, he's got that thing where he's slightly embarrassed about being an actor, and yet he's really good. So he always plays down. He's always like, "Well, I'm rubbish. I'm just someone who turns up."
Have you seen there's an interview on the internet on GQ or something of him talking about his seminal films? And he's so honest about him saying, "Yeah, I went into this after I did Four Weddings and a Funeral, and I thought I'd do something different, but I ended up doing exactly the same thing." And he says about 3 films, I can't remember what they were, but he's so just quite derisory about his own performance, and it's really refreshing to watch. He seems really down to
earth. But I also think that he does it, and you laugh about it, but then you go, but actually, that's really hard. Like, that Four Weddings and a Funeral type thing, to be like a really likeable romantic lead and be funny and be able to do jokes is really hard.
But you just got, what happens, you get in the studio system, you get booked, and then everyone just goes, that's that. Americans love it, so they want the same in Notting Hill, or they want all this, and that's what you're getting paid
but
to
I
do.
Don't think that he's when you watch something like, I mean, we have definitely talked about Hugh Grant before, but I think that when you look at like 9 Months and Mickey Blue Eyes, the film around him is the problem. I mean, 9 Months is
not 9 Months is terrible. I quite like Mickey Blue Eyes.
Yeah, Mickey Blue. Look at the body, yours. My favourite. We've got to play a song.
Yeah.
This is your favourite song. What is it?
Oh, I just picked it because I thought we were going to talk about Watership Down.
We will.
Along the horizon, a stream.
Nick and Nat's Fan Club on FUBAR Radio.
And we're back.
Art Garfunkel on FUBAR Radio.
Art Garfunkel.
So, water shit down. I love it. It's terrifying.
It's brilliant. I mean, I saw it when it was shown on Channel 5 recently. Loads of parents started tweeting in saying it's inappropriate to show this film because of the violence of General Wound Water when he literally rips some rabbits' faces off. But, you know, it's the book is brilliant, and this is one of the few animations that is equal to the book. And the voiceovers, and the voice actors in this are absolutely brilliant. You've got Ralph Richardson's the main narrator. You've got Richard Briers, Roy Kinnear. You've got
John Hurt.
It's absolutely perfect. You won't ever get a cast that good at doing voice work and film.
I remember seeing it around my aunt's house, and she put it on as a kind of kids film and then left, and I remember going and being terrified watching it, going, is this for kids? And it just starts with a rabbit going, oh, the fields are bleeding, and you go, what? Like, the concepts in it, it's like it's blood on there, and you just see all these like weird sort of, and the bit at the start where it has the weird abstract
start. Yeah, the start's brilliant.
It's like Native American cave drawings.
Yes. And it's been ripped off. I saw another program. They actually ripped off the start of Warship Down, having this weird sort of, you know, you said sort of cave drawings like of all the rabbits and the animals and how the rabbit came into being in existence. But some of the animation's great, like all those weird bits when Father's imagining of the warren being filled in, like you said, and you've got the screaming rabbits, really horrific sort of.
the fields have been
really traumatic.
And you just see all these bodies twisting and writhing, these dead rabbit bodies.
And that's 5 minutes in. What the fuck am I
watching?
It's
just like, they've got like the god character going, and if they catch you, they'll kill you. And it just is absolutely horrific.
Have you ever seen Ring of Brightwater?
Oh, I know what you mean. I don't know if I've seen it, actually.
That was a film about a kid that makes friends with an otter.
Sounds lovely.
And at the end, a poacher comes along and murders the otter with a shovel.
Right, what you see, what, with a smash it over his head?
Beats it to death with a shovel. Like, smashes it to death with a shovel. And you just think, and that was a fucking kids' film. You just think, fucking hell.
It's really good that kids are subjected to these traumas early on. That's the problem. It's a snowflake generation. They haven't watched Warship Down enough. Watch that, and what is it called? Otter Shovel film.
Ring of Brightwater.
What is it called, Ring of Brightwater?
Why? I think there's some sort of ring in some dazzling water.
If they'd have called it the Otter Massacre, that would have got more... would have got more views.
It's for kids, huh?
Kids like violence and stuff. I mean, we used to read Grimm's Fairy Tales, and they're all horrifically violent. You know, people getting their arms chopped off and heads chopped off.
Yeah,
and
but really,
like
really, 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 really. But they're cautionary tales, aren't they? They're kind of like if you steer off the path, then you'll get eaten by a wolf. Right? That's the lesson there. In Ring of Brightwater, it's basically don't make friends with an otter.
It'll end in tears.
It's all going to end in tears. Don't be a rabbit.
Do otters bite people's fingers off? What was on the bit Terry Nutkin's finger off?
Was that a ferret?
It was a ferret. But an otter's the same sort of family,
same
isn't
thing.
It?
Stoat, otter.
The ferret is
ferret.
Otter's a water ferret, basically.
That's why it's best to hit him with shovels, just in case it might be an animal that might bite your finger off.
He could have grown
Nutkins.
Up that kid.
It was
and he
Terry
had
Nutkins with a shovel at the end of Ring of Brightwater.
Look at what this prick did to me.
That's like a weird Cluedo game.
It wasn't scripted.
Terry Nutkins with a shovel in some water.
It wasn't scripted. He just walked past the filming and he looked over the fence, see what they were up to, saw the otter, he had a flashback and he went over and said, looks like a fucking ferret, you cunt, and then he smashed it to death with a fucking shovel.
How many times did Terry
Nutkins, though, that's him, he was unpredictable.
Did he hit the otter? How many times did he hit it in the film?
I can't remember. I was like 6-7 months old when
we've got 4 minutes left.
We've got 4 minutes left. How do we keep doing this? What do you do in 4 minutes? What can you do? We've
talk
got the
about
game.
The best animal,
the
game. Best animal deaths. Let's play the game.
Best animal death. Yeah. we play the game. Do you want to play the game? Should we play the game? We'll play the game.
Should we play a game? Yeah. Okay. So this is a game where you have to say whether the next person is better or worse than the person previous. You start off with Robbie Williams. Is Bob Hoskins better or worse than Robbie Williams?
Of course, everyone is better than Robbie Williams.
Yeah, correct. Is Daffy Duck better or worse than Bob Hoskins?
Worse.
Better.
No, Daffy Duck's a prick.
Is Wile E. Coyote better or worse than Daffy Duck?
Wile E. Coyote's better.
Yeah.
He's better. Is Roadrunner better or worse than Wile E. Coyote?
Worse.
Yeah. He's terrible. Is Adam Woodjat, Ian Beale in EastEnders, better or worse than Roadrunner?
I think he's worse.
It's the same.
You want to say better.
He's the same. It's the same character.
He's better than Roadrunner. Is Gene Hackman better or worse than Adam Woodjat?
Of course he's better.
He is better.
Oh.
Is Madonna better or worse than Gene Hackman?
She's worse and she's getting worse by the second.
She is worse. Is Jennifer Aniston better or worse than Madonna?
That's a tough one.
They've both made films with Paul Rudd, haven't they?
I'd say just slightly worse.
I think she's worse than Madonna.
Jennifer Aniston is worse than Madonna?
Yeah, look at Madonna's history of work.
Sure, okay, that's what Michael I was forgetting
J. Fox.
To do.
Is Michael J. Fox better or worse than Jennifer Aniston?
Of course, this is really easy.
Of course, Jennifer Aniston needs two names.
He's better.
As well.
Better. That's it.
That's fun.
It's a good game. It's a good game, isn't it?
This is a very unfocused one. We've got 6 minutes. Yeah, you got six. You got six. You got 6 points.
6 points.
It's a Roger Moore story. It was when he was making The Wild Geese. He was with, what was it? It was Richard Burton, Richard Harris, and Roger Moore.
Yes,
wasn't it? And Roger Moore was just like, "Well, I'm happy not talking at all." So he would give all of his lines to Richard Burton, and he would, "I'm just happy to be here."
He's been paid; he just doesn't have to do the work.
So you watch The Wild Geese; it's often three of them in the shot, and Richard Burton and Richard Harris are having an argument with each other, and Roger Moore stood in the middle, just like looking at each of them, and he's giving his lines away because he was just like, "I think people would rather watch those act." We need to wrap now, so thanks for coming in, Marek.
Thanks.
I got the last laugh. What are we playing? We're playing For Your Eyes Only, Blondie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Cool.